space crowded in my form as I walk deeper into the garden. I've outgrown the feelings of rejection. You know I'm glad to be on my own.
There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize?
Our consciousness is affected.
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
Hi, welcome back to CKUT. This is Unfit to Print on 90.3 FM, broadcasting live from Montreal. My name is Amy Lloyd.
And I'm Maya Bitson.
Today we broadcast from the Geojiage, the traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe Nations. The time now is 5:02.
This week we're back to our regularly scheduled interviews. So today we're playing an interview Amy recorded with the general director from Chez Stella, Sandra Wesley. Stella is a non-for-profit organization established right here in Montreal. Since 1995, Chez Stella has operated in supporting sex workers so that they can live and work in safety and in dignity. In our interview, we inquire about how Chez Stella operates, current issues impacting sex workers, as well as the intersectional relationship between sex work and immigration. Finally, we talk about how we as listeners can be better allies to the sex worker community. We hope you enjoy. Don't go anywhere, we'll be right back after this quick tune from Project Pablo.
Thank you.
That was Napolitana by Project Pablo. The time now is 5:07. Now for our weekly headline roundup.
Do you worry about the state of our climate? Are you frustrated that McGill has invested a total of $50 million in the fossil fuel industry? Do you want to understand more behind why the Board of Governors refuses to divest? On January 20th, next Monday, Divest McGill will be holding an information session regarding the divestment campaign at McGill. The Facebook event states that Divest McGill will be hosting an information session where you can learn about McGill's divestment campaign, environmental justice, and how to get involved. It's time to take action and end these outrageous investments. Join Divest McGill and let's demand that our university respond to the environmental crisis by divesting from fossil fuels. We'll be meeting in location to be determined. Divest 101 will take place from 5:30 to 6:30. If you can't make Divest 101 but still want to get involved, message us or come to one of our weekly meetings on Thursday at 5:30 in the school's downtown campus, unquote. We will be posting the link to the Facebook page on our Twitter. Search for unfit_2_print.
Quebec's Ministry of Education is looking to revise and eventually overhaul the province's long controversial ethics and religion course, which is a compulsory course at Quebec elementary and middle schools. It was established in 2008. It was made to replace the subject of religious and moral education in Quebec schools. However, the course has been an ongoing source of complaints from secularists and nationalists alike in regards to its lack of modernization and its lack of discussion surrounding religious symbols. Education Minister Jean-François Roberge notes that the new program is set to release for the 2022-23 school year and will focus on topics such as democratic rights, legal participation, eco-citizenship, and sex education. Opinions from many groups have been voiced through media reports. Notably, the First Nations Education Council, or FNEC, is advocating for their organization's participation in organizing the curricula. FNEC represents 22 First Nations communities in Quebec and plans to advocate for Indigenous cultural inclusion in the course. You, as a listener, can consult how the new ethics program should be revamped via an online survey offered on the Quebec government website, which is available from January 10th to February 21st.
As of yesterday, January 13th, day school survivors can now officially apply for compensation. In 2009, Gary McLean, a day school survivor from Manitoba, began a multi-billion-dollar class action lawsuit against the Canadian government. This lawsuit was enacted after day school survivors were excluded from residential school settlement agreements. Caroline Bennett, Crown and Indigenous Relations Minister, issued a statement to APTN News saying, quote, "We're taking everything that we've learned from residential school process, a little bit from what we learned after the 60 scoop to not have to go to court," unquote. Unfortunately, McLean died last year before applications for compensation opened. For those who are unaware, day school survivors would not board these schools but still attend them and in turn still suffer the abuses and traumatic events that took place in residential schools. It is estimated that 140,000 individuals make up this class action lawsuit.
Though Montreal boasts high employment rates and successful economic growth, a recent troubling statistic states that 15% of street-level storefronts are vacant. This statistic has been made public, and officials want to reevaluate and consider further consultation regarding how to improve this. This 15% means around 1,000 to 7,000 storefronts are not able to operate, giving streets a desolate and empty feel. This shocking number has since been attributed to the high commercial property tax, high rents from landlord, and restrictive zoning properties, which allow for quicker turnaround between opening and closing independent stores. Another cause of the desolate Montreal shopping strips could be the gradual consumer switch to both online and big brand name shopping. Changes have been requested by small business owners in the past to make it easier to operate their storefronts. In 2015, pleas were made for the Plateau Montreal borough to change zoning in order to allow a greater mix of independent stores. Rather, the municipal government attempted to reason with landlords to drop their rent prices without much luck. Lacking proper data from the government in regards to vacancy, many properties on strips such as Saint-Denis have been brutally vandalized beyond repair. However, there is some hope for the future of these vacant storefronts. Though it is difficult to establish an overall solution for the vacancy problems occurring in each unique neighborhood, statistics show a slight easing of the drastic vacancy rate. The City of Montreal created a plan in 2018 which includes $74 million for business creation, and reports have been made stating property taxes dropped. In the meantime, make sure to shop local and support your friendly neighborhood independent stores in any way that you can.
That was our weekly headline roundup. Please stay tuned for our interview with Stella after this song by the Dorries. Welcome back to Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM. That was Pool Form by the Dorries. The time now is 5:16.
Now it's time for our interview with Sandra Wellesley. Once again, we discuss policing of sex work, the stigma surrounding sex work, and allyship. Enjoy.
Hello.
Hi, is this Sandra?
Yes.
Hi, it's Amy from CKUT.
Hi.
So firstly, for listeners who do not know, would you mind providing a small overview on Chez Stella?
So Stella is an organization by and for sex workers, meaning that the majority of our staff or board members or members are sex workers ourselves. And we provide services in our community in terms of outreach. We reach on average about 8,000 sex workers across Montreal. We distribute condoms, provide accompaniments and support for whatever sex workers need. And we also do advocacy to fight for the rights of sex workers.
So how did CELA begin? What is like some of the history behind this organization?
So CELA started in 1995. We're celebrating our 25th anniversary this year. So it was a project initially born out of some concern in the sex working community around the way HIV prevention was being done. So sex workers being one of the key populations affected by HIV. In the 90s, at the height of the HIV crisis, we were concerned that public health might want to do more coercive measures to prevent sex workers from acquiring or transmitting HIV. We were concerned also about stigma around sex work, and we wanted to help people in our community to be able to address this issue. So that's how CELA came about. Obviously, HIV is only one of the issues that we are concerned with. We're concerned with everything that affects sex workers. That's why our mission is simply improving the working and the living conditions of sex workers. So we started out as a very, very, very small organization, just providing basic things like meals and laundry and showers for sex workers. And over the years, the advocacy part, so a built-up our outreach team, where now we have, on average, about 7 outreach workers working full-time, reaching sex workers all across Montreal. And we're obviously very much involved in advocacy and connected with sex worker groups across Canada and also across the world.
So talking about services, I'm just wondering, how does the outreach sector of your organization work? What does it look like in local Montreal?
So our team does a lot of different things. So the first thing, we're in CELA, we're near Frontenac Metro, and we welcome sex workers here. People can come and either get condoms or other material, or they can come and just talk with someone. They can use our computers, our phones, whatever sex workers need. And we do a lot of activities on site. So we have a monthly community dinner at the last Wednesday of every month. We also have a medical clinic with a nurse from the CLSC who comes every Tuesday night to give anonymous testing to sex workers. And we do other activities here at our offices. And the rest of the work, our outreach team goes out into the community to meet sex workers wherever we are in the community. So that can be doing traditional street work, so going out with a backpack and walking across all of downtown or all of Hochelaga you see outside on the street. It can mean going into all the massage parlors, going into all the strip clubs, meeting with independent escorts, either at the, or meeting people for coffee and coffee shops or restaurants. Wherever sex workers are, that's where we go and meet them.
So you mentioned parlors and strip clubs, and I remember in the month of June in Montreal, police began raiding these parlors and strip clubs. So I'm just wondering, why are these raids problematic?
So there's a lot of repression historically against sex workers for all kinds of reasons, and over the years it shifts sometimes what the justification for it is. These days what police often say is that they're looking for underage girls or that they're looking for people who might be trafficked. So that's the excuse that they use to go into our communities and essentially harass us. So the impact of this is enormous. It creates really a sense of sex workers not being safe in our workplace. If we're migrants, so if we don't have permanent residency in Canada, even if we have a working permit, even if we're here with a valid visa, we can be deported instantly if we're caught doing sex work or working in the sex industry. So that's a real, really, really big impact. Whenever police do a lot of raids, they capture sex workers and then sex workers get deported. It also sends a very strong message to the community, to sex workers, and to potential aggressors that the city is way more concerned with getting rid of us than with protecting our safety. So it creates opportunities then for aggressors to target us, because we then have to protect ourselves more from the police than from potential violent situations in our work. It obviously increases the stigma against sex workers, and And whenever those raids happen, the effect can be felt for months and years after that. It also scares away some of our better clients, and that's a big problem because it can really affect our income, and not just our income, also simply if all the good clients are becoming a bit more afraid to see us, then we end up having to contend with clients that are maybe not the best, and that might negotiate more. And if clients feel that they're at risk of getting arrested, then they expect more for less, and they expect us to not use our traditional screening methods. So there's a lot of really massive impacts for sex workers whenever operations like that happen. And the operations themselves are usually a really gross violation of sex workers' rights. This summer, they were doing things like stamping sex workers with after they saw them, and writing down everyone's tattoos and piercings under the guise of protecting us by saying that that way they'll be able to identify our bodies if we ever get murdered, which is a classic tactic that police use to make us feel like sex work is inherently unsafe. And they will explicitly say that, usually, that they're trying to scare us away from doing sex work. And that's highly problematic on many, many levels.
When I was researching these raids, I found a statement that said that they were doing this, like you mentioned, the stamping, and that they did that to build a database so that sex workers can be identified when they, quote, show up dead, unquote. Why is rhetoric such as this dangerous for sex workers and, you know, for them to work safely in Montreal?
So this kind of statement is something that comes out of American law enforcement against sex workers. So as far as I know, like the first time I've heard about this was a few years ago when they identified that around a few truck stops, it was likely that there was one or more serial killers that were targeting sex workers. And so they're, instead of, you know, investigating every trucker and getting to the bottom of it, what they decided to do was to just get sex workers to stop working if they could. And they started meeting with the sex workers at those truck stops and taking pictures of their tattoos and piercings, and then telling them that they would most certainly be murdered. And they justify that saying, well, if we tell them how dangerous it is, then they'll stop doing sex work. And that goes back to the laws that we have now in Canada that aim to get rid of sex workers. There's nothing in the laws right now that aims to protect us. The objective of the law is to eliminate sex work. So that's what informs police's work. And obviously in real life, if someone comes and tells us that they think we're going to end up dead, it does not in any way take away our rent or other bills. Mm-hmm. We still need to work. We still need to make money. And all it does is really reinforce this idea that we're disposable. It's very dehumanizing. And it really reinforces this message that those actual aggressors are hearing from our governments, from police, that yes, it is okay to target us, that it's normal, that violence against sex workers is just a fact of life, and that it's okay. So it's very problematic. And the fact that they're using public money to do this, they're wasting all these resources while sex workers can't actually access police services when we do need them, is really highly problematic.
So speaking of language in general, what are some other phrases or terms used in the mainstream dialogue regarding sex work that could be considered harmful?
So as sex workers, we choose to use the term sex work because it's a term that we feel recenters that it's a job, it's work, it's not an identity, it's not something morally wrong. And we'll use other words also in our own work. So someone might identify as a stripper, as an escort, or as a masseuse, or whatever it is that she does in the sex industry. So those terms are usually acceptable. Some of the terms that are used usually against us include prostitutes or prostituted women. So those terms really really treat us as passive victims and not as people with agency. And they really are tied to an ideology that doesn't respect our rights or our existence at all. Other terms that we hear talked about a lot, especially right now in Quebec, things like sexual exploitation, are super problematic because those terms, even though they sound like they must mean something, and we're obviously all against sexual exploitation, what happens more often than not is that all of sex work gets defined with those really vague terms, and that becomes a justification to infantilize us or to not listen to what we have to say or to justify repression against us. And the same thing would apply to human trafficking, which is a term that's used constantly right now to refer usually to all of sex work. The reality, obviously, is that most sex workers are not experiencing trafficking, and that if we do experience trafficking, then it's not something inherent to the sex industry. It's something that happens because we have no rights as workers, and that's why we need to bring it back to the notion of work, the notion of labor rights. And obviously, there's tons of words that are used to insult sex workers or to insult women in general by calling women sex workers, which is also another big problem that we have in our society, that women who are not sex workers get obviously very offended when they're called something that resembles a sex worker, and that's part of how the stigma against sex workers continues to exist and to be amplified in our society.
Speaking of stigmas, what are some of the greatest challenges, in your opinion, that sex workers in Montreal face?
The big thing that we're fighting for, which we always say is step one, it won't solve everything in our lives, but it's the first steps that's needed for us to be able to move forward, is we need to decriminalize sex work. The laws that we have in place right now that criminalize all of sex work are extremely harmful and violate our rights and make it impossible for us to actually work on improving our working conditions. We don't have access to labor protections. We don't have access to occupational health and safety protections. We don't have access to any of that. Because our work is criminalized, we can be evicted from our housing because sex work is criminalized. So that's the really big thing that we need. We also need to change immigration policies. As I mentioned earlier, sex workers can be deported if we don't have permanent residency in Canada. And that creates extreme vulnerability for migrant sex workers who know that any attempt to call the police will likely be met with a deportation. And our friends in Toronto and in Vancouver that work directly, organizations by and for migrant sex workers, did surveys in their communities. And it was very clear that the vast majority of migrant sex workers would never call the police, no matter what happens. And they had stories of sex workers being robbed or sex workers being beaten or, you know, assaulted in other ways and not being able to contact the police, and even situations where the police was called to in a situation where a sex worker was assaulted and their only concern at the time was figuring out whether or not she could be deported. So that's really a really massive issue that we're facing. And obviously the way all of that gets articulated into police repression contributes to this, the direct impact of these laws. And in Quebec especially, the hysteria around all this false information about the presence of underage people in the sex industry is really harming all sex workers.
So I saw that on Stella's Twitter, you all were working with Pivot Legal Society, and you published a resource titled Policy Brief, Sex Workers and Travel Restrictions. Would you mind explaining the importance behind discussing, you know, these travel restrictions, why they relate to sex work, what travel restrictions are?
Sex workers are banned from entering the United States, among other countries. There are many places also that have similar policies. And there's different reasons why there's such policies. In the U.S., it's under a very vague law that says that anyone who doesn't meet the moral standard to enter in the U.S. Should be banned. And the way it's applied is that any sex worker, anyone who's worked in the sex industry in the past 10 years, can potentially be banned at the border and not allowed to enter the U.S. So we see this happening all the time to sex workers, and with the increased use of technology for border enforcement, it's getting worse. So we'll see that sometimes sex workers will show up at the border and border enforcement have already seen her escort ads because they're doing facial recognition or they're doing other things. They're tracking phone numbers. They're tracking all kinds of information. Sometimes when a sex worker goes to the border and she gets rejected, they'll also have her unlock her phone and actually look at all of her contacts. And that can be a way to investigate. So they're actively enforcing this. It's not just something that if you're so obviously a sex worker that that the border agent recognizes you as a sex worker that you'll get banned. They're actively investigating and looking for sex workers to ban. And in many other places, this is based in the notion of anti-trafficking. So human trafficking became a big topic in the 90s, primarily by anti-immigration groups who really wanted to look for excuses to close down borders. Over time, it became more of an anti-sex work thing specifically, but there's a very close connection between anti-human trafficking and closing down borders. So anyone who might be a sex worker who's suspected of maybe going into a country to do sex work tends to get turned away at a lot of borders, and usually, obviously, it's Western countries that are banning people from countries that are experiencing more poverty or the effects of colonialism, and that's a really big problem that affects a lot of people. And it's something at Stella, we've published a guide for sex workers in Canada who want to travel to the U.S., so some tips and information to minimize the risk of being turned away at the border. And we're working also with international groups to work on this issue of conflating sex work and trafficking. One of the very interesting groups that works on this is GATSW, the Global Alliance Against Trafficking in Women. So they do a lot of work to really disentangle sex work and trafficking so that we can actually defend the rights of sex workers and also prevent trafficking.
So in your opinion, what is the best legal structure to support sex workers?
So what we're fighting for is full decriminalization. So what this means is to remove any mention of sex work in the criminal code. That's very different from legalization, which would be a model a bit like what we've done in Canada for cannabis, where we carve out a little area where sex work can be done legally, and then we keep all kinds of criminal code provisions for anyone who goes outside of that norm. So for us, it's really important to have full decriminalization because we need all sex workers to benefit from it. We need sex workers who are in situations of poverty, people working on the street, people working indoors, migrant sex workers, indigenous sex workers. We need everyone to benefit from decriminalization, and that only happens through full decriminalization. And so that model would then allow the use of other criminal code provisions when we actually do experience crime. So if the sex worker is assaulted, well, then there's still a charge of assault that could be used in that moment, but no blanket charges for anyone in the sex industry as it is right now. Right now, any client that communicates with us can be arrested. All third parties in the sex industry, meaning receptionists, drivers, friends who help us, so everyone who assists us in any way is criminalized. Advertising is also criminalized, and many other aspects of sex work. So we want to get rid of all of that, and that's how we can start to actually look at what can occupational health and safety do for sex workers? What can labor protections that already exist for all workers, how can they be applied to sex work, and how can they help us? And that would allow also everyone in the sex industry to actually come up with business models that work for us, that allow us to work safely, that allow us to have as much control as possible over our working conditions. And it's also the best way to protect people in the industry that might be victims of exploitation or violence. Because right now, one of the biggest barriers for people seeking help is the fact that the industry is criminalized. So if we work, for example, in a massage parlor and we see one of our colleagues who comes to work and is experiencing violence at home and maybe doesn't want to be there, well, we can try to help her directly, but we can't get the authorities involved because we know the second we do that, we're all going to lose our income. So in a decriminalized context, we become then the best allies to help people in our industry that are experiencing violence, which is the same as any other industry. Whenever workers have been at risk of violence in their workplace or of other dangers, the first thing that we do is to give them more rights, and that's how we protect workers.
So you mentioned earlier that Stella is an organization by and for sex workers. And so I'm wondering, How does one go about accomplishing this, and why is it important to incorporate the sex workers into the administration aspect of the organization?
So for us, it's really important on many levels. So the first one is that when we're fighting for the rights of the community, well, we're the people that are best placed to fight for our own rights. We know what we need. We know what works for us and what doesn't work. So it's really important that we don't let other people speak for us. And as sex workers, and this is true of all other marginalized communities, a lot of people really like to talk about us, to make policies that concern us without ever consulting us. And one of the big ways that they do that is by claiming to be sometimes the voice of the voiceless, or by otherwise playing on the fact that we don't have the safety to be able to speak out publicly. So an organization like Stella, what we do is that collectively we then create a possibility for us to speak up and to have our needs heard, even though we don't have a lot of different people who can speak publicly for the organization. Everything we do is accountable to all sex workers in our community. So we do this by consulting sex workers, by making sure that everyone's input is always heard, and by making sure that it's not simply my position as a sex worker that gets heard, but that everything I say is inclusive of what everyone in the community has to say about it. There's also, just on the basis of the services that we offer, it's a lot easier for someone to connect with a sex worker if you're also a sex worker yourself. Obviously, we're very, we don't trust outsiders coming into our community to help us. Social workers can be very dangerous. They can take away our kids. They can cause all kinds of problems in our lives. Other people who don't come from our community often have the goal to get us out of sex work, or they don't understand what we're going through. Well, if it's a sex worker who comes to us in our workplace and offers us help, then we don't have to explain our whole life to this person. We know that there's this inherent trust and understanding that we both have of what our experiences are. And finally, I think that the other thing is that we have to believe in the skills and the capacity of sex workers. We're a very diverse community. We have people with all kinds of incredible talents, from art to management to anything it requires to run an organization and to thrive as an organization. All those abilities exist in our community, and so it's our job to go out and to build that capacity, to draw out those skills from our community, and to, as soon as you take away the stigma, then you can really have people that are empowered and are doing really amazing things. So that's why it's so important for us to remain by and for, and to make sure that that no one who isn't from our community gets to speak on our behalf.
When I was researching Stella, I noticed you guys had a clinic. So what separates Stella's clinic from other clinics around the city?
So the most important thing about our clinic is that it happened at Stella. So sex workers come in a space where they already feel comfortable coming. Because it's our space, we control the way the clinic goes. The nurse comes from the CLSC, but she works respectfully and within our... One of the big services that she offers that isn't offered in a lot of places, anonymous testing. So anyone can come in, even if they don't have a health card, they can give any name that they want, and it's never going to get traced back to them. This is essential for sex workers because there can be such big consequences to being identified as a sex worker and having that in our medical file. People can lose other jobs, people can have trouble and eventually maybe even lose their kids over it. We've seen a lot of horror stories of what happens when that information is in the medical file. So sex workers are able to come and trust that it's not going to have any impact like that on their lives. And also it's a space that's respectful. It's very daunting for a sex worker to go and just ask their doctor for testing, because the questions that we get asked are very intrusive or not adapted, and it's really hard for someone to know what they have to tell the truth about and what they don't, what's not necessarily relevant. One of the big questions that is very, very embarrassing for sex workers is when we go and a nurse or a doctor asks us how many sexual partners we've had, let's say in the past 3 months or since our last test. As sex workers, and it's not a number that we usually keep track of, and it's not something we want to discuss. And in reality, it has no medical use. You know, simply needing a test should be enough, and that question doesn't actually help anyone. So our nurse here doesn't ask those questions. She only asks the questions that are necessary for her to be able to do the service that the person needs. And then the other aspect of our clinic is that we have, it's a great place for sex workers to meet other sex workers, and we tend to do activities also at the same time. We like to do what we call aromatherapy, where we do little sprays and bath salts and lotions with essential oils, and sex workers can leave with the thing that they made. And it's just a great way to connect with the community in the context where more and more sex workers are isolated and don't work every day with other sex workers. And that fills a really, really big need, I think, for a lot of sex workers who don't see a lot of other sex workers and rarely have a space where they can sit down and just talk about their work honestly and openly without being judged.
And what are some of Sela's upcoming projects in the next year?
So this year we're celebrating our 25th anniversary, so we're just launching the program for the year. We try to schedule activities most months during the year, so we have very interesting things such as readings of writings. We have a book launch. In April, we have a big party at Cafe Clio to celebrate our 25th anniversary and to launch our new Constellation magazine. We're also doing a film festival in September at the Cinéma L'Amour and a burlesque show. So we have a lot of things going on this year in terms of activities for our 25th anniversary. So we look forward to seeing a lot of people participating in this. We're also working really hard following the elections to get sex work on the agenda in Ottawa and to get decriminalization to happen during this term of this government. So we do need the public support to signal to the government that sex workers' rights is a priority and that it is something that and that the government should be looking at. And other than that, we're continuing to do our usual work of outreach and activities within our community. So if there are any sex workers listening, then they're always welcome to come and drop by or give us a call, and we can connect them with our community.
And lastly, what can non-sex worker allies do to create an environment where sex workers can practice their job safely?
So the main thing, the first thing that allies can do is to not judge sex workers and to support us openly. So this can be in any level of society. It can be anything from if you have a massage parlor in your neighborhood to contact your city officials and tell them that you don't want them to close it down or to harass them. It can be if you're a social worker or a nurse or someone who might encounter sex workers, to make sure that you're a safe person for sex workers to disclose that to and to signal that. It could be small things such as having a poster in your office somewhere or some other way to signal that you're safe. Obviously, people should be denouncing repression against sex workers like Operation Radar conducted by the SPVM and anything else. So just to vocally oppose those things and to obviously not participate in them. Another thing that people can do is whatever spheres that they exist in, be it in university, in their program, or in their employment, to really ask themselves, would it be safe for a sex worker to be here? Would it be safe for a sex worker to be in my class right now? Would it be safe for a sex worker to work with me? Would we fire someone if she's a sex worker? And if the answer is that it's not safe, then people should be doing things to change that. A lot of professions would not allow a sex worker or a former sex worker from being part of that profession. I can think about social workers, for example, or even sexologists, from what I understand, would not allow someone with experience of sex work to represent the profession. So those are all the little things that people can work on and fight to change and make sure that any organization that they're part of actually takes the position to support decriminalization of sex work and expresses that position publicly.
Well, thank you so much for speaking with us today, Sandra.
My pleasure.
Have a good day.
Welcome back to Unfit to Print. We hope you enjoyed our interview with Sandra. To learn more about Stella, you can visit their website. Search for chesstella.org. We will also post the link on our Twitter, unfit_to_print.
Frigid girls, and why you say so did it's time. Boy, hey, what you're bringing out into myself is that you're just a clumsy man. You've been up seven skies lately, so I don't wonder why, but never told of doubting yourself. Used to make love.
Touche mes mains, mes mains qui touchent.
Welcome back. You're listening to Unfit to Print on CKUT 90.3 FM. You just heard Mama Said by Cherry Lena, followed by Recommencer by Hubert Lenoir.
We want to thank listeners for tuning in to another episode of Unfit. Also, an additional thank you to Sandra for talking to us. Catch us next week on 90.3 FM at the same time. Playing us out, we have Set in Stone by Milk and Bone. Thank you.
Can't bulldoze over my people. Our land, our final say. No pipelines will come in our land.